Welcome to Comadres y Comics.
Comadres y Comics is a podcast hosted by three Latina women.
We focus on the Latinx presence in the comic industry,
with a special focus on strong female characters and creators.
Back to episode 19. We are your hosts. I'm Sarah.
I'm Jen.
And I'm Kristen.
What's up, Kristen?
Oh, we got some awesome chisme de la semana today, this week. We are going to have awesome creator Sam Humphries, writer of Green Lanterns and Josie, two of the books that we're going to be reviewing today on episode 19. He will be joining us at the end of this interview. Or, I'm sorry, at the end of this podcast. With his interview.
Exactly. So keep that under your cap. So, guys, we are reviewing, what are we reviewing today, guys?
We're reviewing the second volume of both Jonesy and Green Lanterns. Mm-hmm. Those of you who have been listening to Comadres y Comics know that we've individually reviewed both of the volume ones of both of these books, Jonesy and Green Lanterns, and it's really cool to see kind of the differing storytelling techniques and ways that Sam Humphries is able to just kind of have two totally different at the different spectrum of storytelling, an all ages book in Jonesy and then a DC superhero book, Green Lanterns. And so today we're doing both in honor of the fact that he will be here with us today.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So let's start with Green Lanterns Volume 2. What did you guys think of this story arc so far?
I loved it. I loved Rage Planet, but I honestly think the Phantom Lantern, which is the name of Volume 2, is an even better storyline.
Absolutely.
It's so much more compelling.
Mm-hmm.
And I love everything about it. I learned a lot about the Green Lanterns themselves.
Yeah, me too.
In this volume, because out of all the superheroes, I think I know the least about the Green Lanterns.
Yeah.
And I got a lot of info, and that in itself is pretty cool. I feel like I can understand like what it is that the Green Lanterns do, how they're chosen, and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the story itself, Jessica has come a long way.
She really has.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm so proud of her.
You know what? The development of her character in this story arc was something that was really compelling for me to read. And what I really liked about her particular development is that the fact that we all know she's dealing with anxiety, and we all know that she has PTSD based from the incident that happened in the woods with her friends and, you know, what she had seen happen to them. But what I think a lot of writers do, or at least what I've seen happen in some other stories, is that writers might just briefly mention that a character has a certain, you know, problem, whether it's a mental health issue or a physical issue, and then maybe touch upon it for that panel, and then we never hear about it again.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But in this storyline and the development of this arc, we see, and I think it's more realistic and true to nature.
Definitely.
of anxiety, that it really rears its head almost every single time.
You could be in the most perfect moment of your life, and it would still be there in the background. Like, you will be, like, happy and everything. And, like, in a scene in this one, when she realizes that she does have the willpower, like, it's still there. She still has to, like, overcome it, but the feeling of the willpower is still stronger than it.
Yeah.
That
was actually a really awesome...
That was my favorite scene.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love that. It was great.
And and that's one of the things I really liked about this, is that with her inner monologue, you constantly know the struggle she's going through.
Yes.
And how you see how she's growing into it, and she's actually learning to deal with it, but she still struggles with it, which is which is really interesting. And you see her progressing as the story goes on, which I really like.
Right, because an easy and lazy way to write this character would have just been, hey, you know, she's the Green Lantern now, so everything's better.
Everything's,
you know,
if the ring,
you know, chose her, then, you know, she should just forget about all the other stuff, and she should just go go with it. Mm-hmm. But just like Jen, how you were saying, that anxiety, it's and the way that it is so realistically portrayed in the book is that the anxiety doesn't matter what it is that is going on with you that's so wonderful that it's there, just kind of the negative self-talk just over and over again, and seeing her inner dialogue in there, and Simon's as well. I mean, he has his own demons that he has to.
That kind of like that anger issue I see a lot. One of the things that I thought was really amazing was when you get to see that she has even anxiety even when she's just hanging out with Simon's family.
Yes.
Yeah.
And one of the most amazing, my most favorite parts in this second volume is the part where she is actually, because of her anxiety, she always questions everything, including why she's the Green Lantern. But in this, in a certain spot in this book, she questions, are the rings truly choosing the correct person to be the Green Lantern? Mm-hmm. How do we know they're right? Just because they say they are and we accept it? I mean, she went on a whole tangent, and I was like, yes. It's challenging us to question everything, and in the end, she gets her answer, but I'm just like, this is good shit.
I really, really am enjoying the journey that Sam is taking us on in just the development of Simon and Jessica's partnership. Because we saw from volume one that it, you know, he didn't want a partner, period. And then she was just really trying to struggle with even accepting that she was worthy of the ring. And we come to the second story arc where some of that stuff has kind of lessened a little bit, but there are still issues that both of them have. And I like that it rings true to me that it's slowly evolving, that it's not just, you know, okay, second story arc, everything's good now.
Yeah.
Exactly, exactly.
Definitely. And then the story, just to get a little bit into the storyline. So in the previous volume, it had ended with one of the guardians coming to Simon's house. Rami,
I like that guy.
Coming to Simon's house, and he's looking for the Green Lantern because he created a ring that didn't choose the bearer. The bearer.
Phantom ring.
Yeah, the bearer. Anybody could wear it, and it was called the Phantom Ring. And so now Simon and Jessica, since they can't get in contact with the bigger league, I used air quotes, or the bigger league,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but one of the things I like is like how the little kids are like, call me when the real Green Lantern comes.
I know, the little kids are so salty.
They're savage. So it's just Simon and Jessica, and they're trying to get in contact with Hal Jordan or even Guy Gardner or John Stewart.
Anyone.
Anybody, but they can't. So it's just them.
Yeah.
Where is Kyle in all this? Off tangent, but I'm just like, I just realized like Kyle isn't even mentioned. Well, he was mentioned once. Whatchamacallit? When the main, I guess, well, one of the antagonists was thinking about it.
Yeah.
But basically, this guy, his name's Frank. He finds out via Voltoom, who was the first Lantern ever, that there is a Phantom Ring, and Frank has wanted to be a Green Lantern ever since his life was saved by Hal Jordan, and so he's determined. Absolutely determined to be a Green Lantern. So, of course, he falls to the machinations of Voltoom, who tells him, there's a Phantom Ring, I can lead you to it, but you gotta do something for me. Of course, there's always a stipulation.
I mean, he's not only dedicated, I mean, this guy is obsessed.
He's obsessed. Yeah, he's obsessed.
Like, it's like crazy obsessed. I mean, he says no to love, and he says no to a regular life, and he's just... You know, just training and doing his own vigilante work on the side, and
that didn't quite work out.
Right, he gets his butt kicked, and during him getting his butt kicked, he's like, "It's worth it." You know, like I'm like, "You are fucked." You're a really sick guy.
Yeah, and he's just like So he falls to the machinations of Voltoom, and he kidnaps Rami, steals the Phantom Ring, and the Phantom Ring has the powers of all seven lanterns.
Mm-hmm.
So it can, the downside is that it has none of the restrictions. So he gets easily consumed by it.
One of the other things I liked was there was no lantern to power the ring.
The ring
is powered
off
by
their own emotions.
Emotions. So basically,
the wearer is the battery.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And so it has the capacity to actually blow the person up if they're not careful.
Yeah.
And there are no filters with the ring, so when they feel an emotion, it really takes over the entirety of the persona.
And now we finally get the answer why they have the dumb battery.
That was one of my questions when I first reread Green Lanterns, actually for one of our Heidi Ho comic trade paperback discussion groups, and I'm like, that is so stupid. Like, why do you need a dumb battery? But now that is actually...
Now you know.
That actually is like, it makes sense to me.
Yeah, now it makes sense. And now the battery is no longer dumb.
Yeah.
And in the book itself, you can see that the Green Lantern ring wasn't just made. There was trial and error before that. That's the whole thing with Voltoon.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really cool because I knew none of this before. Even if it was just like, I know Voltoon isn't new. He's been here, and there was like Wrath of the First Lantern or something like that. That was a while ago. The Green Lanterns itself is my most... least favorite, but I haven't read a lot of it. I like the Green Lanterns themselves, except for Guy Gardner. But I just haven't really read a lot about them. So I'm getting all of this information new, and I think that was really, really cool of Sam to include, and just really specifically, like, this is what happened. The Guardians messed up.
Yeah.
And in their mess up, they decided, okay, we're gonna do the Green Lanterns first. And we see that Rami was the actual creator for it. It wasn't just, like, the Guardians were like, yes, like, we can do this. But Rami himself was the one who created the Green Lantern rings, and I think who created the other
Phantom
one.
Which was why he was exiled for so long.
Yeah, he was exiled, because they were like, this is your curse, this is your burden now. Either destroy it and come back, or you have to safeguard it until... for all eternity. And I was just like, damn, man, that's cold.
Yeah, and even though he was so proud of it at the beginning, during the many, many millions and millions and millions of years that have passed, he's realized that it's more of a curse. He's tried to destroy it and was unable to do so.
Yeah.
And they explained that too, which was, I thought, really refreshing, because you know what's going on. You just aren't just given information and just left... kind of to your imagination. They actually let you know that it's indestructible, which you know, would be your first thought as a reader, like, why don't you just destroy it? But you know that it's indestructible. But this ring is it's pretty crazy. Whatever happens to you, you start feeling like either angry, scared, or whatever, and it just takes over.
Yeah.
And you get like 100 times that emotion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And only that emotion.
It's like it's the ring of the teenage angst years.
Oh my God. You only you get locked onto one emotion, and that's it. And that is how they, in the end, defeated Frank, the Phantom Lantern. And I love everything about this book.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. For me, I mean, I'm like, okay, what's going to happen next? Like, I couldn't stop turning the page. I think I took a little Facebook break, but then I'm like, okay, I want to know what happened next. Okay, break's over. Let's keep going.
Let's keep going.
Yeah.
So it turns out I actually had read these in single issues, except for maybe the last two. And so it kind of was re-cementing what I had already read, but always when reading in trade form, I think I retain a lot more of the story. So I was really enjoying, like I said, the journey that both characters were taking, not only in their partnership, but also individually as Green Lanterns. And of course, at the end of this story arc, as is the case in most comic book ongoings, there is a little bit of a cliffhanger.
Oh, yeah. That cliffhanger was
I actually read the last three pages twice because I'm like, wait a minute, no.
It can't be.
Yeah, it was really amazing. And one of the things that I liked was because Jessica dons the ring, the mm-hmm. phantom ring, for a little bit of a moment, and she is actually, her eyes are open. And the only way I could describe this is like when you take acid and then like you feel that the whole world is unified. It's like she actually understands the question, her questioning herself as mm-hmm. far as always being afraid and always having the anxiety. Mm-hmm. And I think it pushes her towards being more accepting of her being the Green Lantern. And uh-huh. I thought that was really an epic moment in this book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when she, actually, as the reader, the way that those panels read, I myself was not sure what was going to happen.
Yeah, me too.
Because
it grabs you visually, and uh-huh. then you're just like, what's happening?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I definitely give props to Sam for that kind of, like, aha moment for Jessica.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And going on to Simon himself, his relationship with his mom mm-hmm. is
oh
so...
Oh, my God, yes.
I've been there, my guy. I've been there. Like,
I know.
It's always such a touchy subject. And even, like, I love the fact that you can be a superhero and sometimes your parents will be like, really?
Yeah.
That's what you're going to do with your life?
That was also some of my favorite stuff there. And as I was reading it, I'm like, dude, I feel you because I've been there, too.
Yeah.
Like, she mm-hmm. scares me. But because there's a moment where Jessica's like, why don't you just do your own thing? And she's like, you don't understand. She's my hero.
Yeah,
like,
she's
I'm scared
hero.
Of her, and she's my hero.
She's
like,
my hero.
She's going to be salty, but she still loves me. Like, that's weird.
It was like a rough and tender moment mm-hmm. at the same time. And I was just like, I absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
Because it's just, it's the whole question of like, what are you gonna do with your life, and like, are you gonna make your parents proud, and all that stuff. And I was just like, I was almost close to tears when I had been reading it, and I was just like, aw, Simon, you just wanna do you, but you also wanna do like the best for the people that raised you, and sometimes it's enough, and sometimes you feel like it isn't.
And mm-hmm. I really love that in the story that Sam is creating for Simon, that yes, we get to see his family, but we also get to see the cultural aspects
of him in
their food and just in their dress, mm-hmm. all that stuff. I love that is all incorporated.
I'm gonna be on the hunt for those cookies.
I wanna
try them, like, legit. Honestly, I love that whole interaction, because in the beginning, Jessica, she was right there, and she was just like, I said I would do this, and she was like, oh, nope, I can't do it, I'm a garbage person, and like a garbage person, I'm gonna leave, and I have felt like that exact same sentiment. And all Simon says is like, we're gonna have cookies that are better than cookies, and she's just like,
what?
Cookies? And it literally, like, sometimes, especially with people, like, with an anxiety, or with depression, or with something, sometimes it's just the small things that literally convince us to stay or to stick around.
Yeah.
It's like, it doesn't have to be like anything big, or like there's like you promised or something, and just be like, we're gonna have cookies, or like, oh, there's gonna be food or pizza later, and I'm just like, oh, I want pizza. I'm down. All right, I'll stay.
Yeah, definitely. The artwork here was really, really great too. And like you said, the paneling with the and they did that same style panel for whenever they put on the ring, mm-hmm. the Phantom ring, and I thought that was really impressive.
Oh, with mm-hmm. all the different seven emotions and
I like that too. And it was a kind of a moment where there was a pause while you're reading that page, because you don't know what's going to happen in the second page.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a nice, interesting kind of pause.
Nice pacing.
Pacing.
Yes, definitely. Green Lanterns was one of my favorites when Rebirth started. Mm-hmm. I started reading every single Rebirth title that came out, and Green Lanterns from the very early beginnings really went to the top for me, and was something that I really enjoyed reading, and continued to read until I couldn't keep up with the with all the DC Rebirth coming out, most of it coming out twice a month. Mm-hmm. Every other week, it just got too much, so I went to reading trades. But I just love that it is a little bit of a different take on a superhero story.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And like I said, the monologue, both Green Lanterns have like an inner monologue that, you know, you can see inside the person and their personality and how, you know, they second guess themselves or they're struggling with, you know, doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
We see Simon struggling with not trying to put on the Phantom Ring,
right?
Mm-hmm. You know, because we all want fame and fortune and we want to be powerful. So for him, the struggle was like, hey man, this is not for you. Like, you're the Green Lantern.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which I thought was really cool about this.
Yeah. So and it's that his struggle and Jessica's struggle, I really like too, that they're so completely like at the separate points of the spectrum, where mm-hmm. Jessica thinks she's not good enough for the ring, and Simon is scared that the ring is not good enough
for him.
For him, that mm-hmm. it's not enough power for him, that mm-hmm. he wants more.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that those two things, and then how that interacts in their relationship together, and how at the end Simon was able to. I really thought he was going to put it on.
Yeah, I did too. I thought so too.
I thought he was going to put it on.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I thought, no, he's just going to put it on and it's going to be a whole new bag of worms. But no, can of worms. I'm not sure how
can of worms. Can of worms unspilled.
You know, because I think I'm more leaning towards Jessica Cruz and more vested in her as a character. But Simon is definitely growing on me.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm.
And I can relate, especially with his mom's relationship with him and him being... He identifies himself as like the bad seed, like the bad one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and he put his family through so much. He says he says so in the book, and I can relate to that now. So now
it's a little bit of a mm-hmm. self-fulfilling prophecy, I think, too, for him, because he was a troubled youth,
mm-hmm.
and I worked with troubled youth a lot, where they had people telling them so often that they are bad, that they that it's their fault that bad things happen to the families, bad things happen to them, mm-hmm. and when you hear that so often, you start to believe it, mm-hmm. and then you say, well, if everyone thinks those things, then might as well be those things,
mm-hmm.
and I think
mm-hmm.
you see Simon struggling with that mm-hmm. in this book for sure,
trying to see himself as the hero.
Yeah.
Both of them do, in their own unique ways, but they're both starting to see themselves as the heroes
mm-hmm.
that they are destined to be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
Yeah, and I really like how, like, you see them as, for lack of a better word, they're kind of green as superheroes.
Yeah.
and they're coming into their own, and they're, and they're, accepting their powers and their responsibility and how to handle specific things like media, for instance. There was an instance where they were in front of the Phantom Lantern who had turned green,
mm-hmm.
and the media was there, the television media was there,
mm-hmm.
and then Batman is like,
I know,
what the heck are you doing?
Yeah, he's like, don't argue with a fool, the audience doesn't know he's a fool.
Right.
Yeah. And I thought that was good. That gave me the conclusion that Batman knew that, whatchamacallit, that the guy that they were after was not a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
So he believes the Green Lanterns, but
he
knows that the media won't, because the guy had just saved a kid.
Right. Yeah.
And that also speaks mm-hmm. to what Batman feels about them. Like,
mm-hmm.
he didn't immediately step in. He let them handle it. Maybe he was patrolling the event
uh-huh.
in case it got out of control, but he basically let them take care of it.
Yeah.
Which, although we don't know what's going on and where all the other Green Lanterns are, I feel like that is what they're doing too.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully we'll find out what's going on, and mm-hmm. and the two lanterns that came at the end, the two alien lanterns.
John Stewart and the other... They said his name, but I can't remember it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
They said where they were. They didn't say what they were doing, but they said where they were. So I'm hoping that we kind of learn that people, or the lanterns, and they're also, Simon and Jessica we can't forget they're part of the Justice League. They talked about it
here.
But so there's people around to help. But I think they are all really, it's kind of like the whole you learn to sink or swim. I think that maybe, hopefully we'll find out that that's what's going on here.
And as heroes, I'm sure they can't get helicopter parented into it.
They
have to throw them into the pool and see if they swim.
So on a scale of 1 to 3 conchas, what do we give Green Lantern?
3 conchas and a pan dulce. 3 conchas and a champurrado, definitely for me.
I second that.
I definitely agree. 3 conchas and a glass of champurrado. I love Green Lanterns. I highly recommend it. If you are wary, if you're an indie reader and you're wary about getting into superhero comics, I highly recommend Green Lanterns as kind of a gateway into the DC superhero world.
Yeah, definitely.
I actually like the second book more so than the first. I just felt more attuned with the second one. I don't know how to tell the audience that, but if you weren't completely sucked in on the first one, definitely read the second one. One will just it will cement it in. You'll really like it. I feel you'll really like it.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. So, Green Lanterns is not the only Sam Humphries book that we're reviewing this episode. One of my favorite books that we have in the All Ages section of Heidi Ho Comics is Jonesy. And we've read Jonesy Volume 1 before. And Jonesy Volume 2 is just more of this awesome little spitfire Latina girl who has the ability to make people fall in love, and not just with other people, but also with things and ideas. So imagine if you had that power when you were a teenager, the havoc that you could have wreaked.
And as a good intention as she is, or as more of a fit she throws when she does these things, it always goes wrong.
So in this volume 2, we kind of get a little bit of a insight into more of her crush on stuff.
Stuff
is the major. I always, when I read this, in my mind, I just pictured Justin Bieber for some reason. when he was his prime, when he was fresh off of YouTube.
Yeah. For me, stuff is more like K-pop. He's so flamboyant in his appearance. Uh-huh.
That's true.
That's what I see when I see stuff.
A bit Justin Bieber, a bit K-pop. Yeah. That's what I get the vibe of.
So Jonesy is in love with stuff and is trying, because the one thing that we didn't share is that her powers cannot work on herself. She cannot make other people fall in love with her.
Mm-hmm.
So she is devising some plan to get stuff to somehow fall in love with her. So she gets a little bit creative by making stuff fall in love with the social media presence of her hometown.
Yeah.
And then fall in love with her zine.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's all about stuff.
It's all about stuff. Yeah. And so with that, stuff has to meet the creator of the zine, which is Jonesy herself. And I really loved it. I love her relationship with her grandma.
I knew you were going to say that because I love it too.
Her grandma's so cool. She reminds me of like a little one of the, what's the Devereaux, the one from Golden Girls, the one that's Blanche Devereaux.
Blanche Devereaux.
She sure does, isn't she? Oh my God.
My favorite is when she gives her heartbreaker dress.
Yes.
So, oh my God. So Jonesy's grandma was apparently a heartbreaker when she was in Mexico City, and she had this dress that she wore that she used to break the hearts of all the boys in Mexico City, but she didn't. She was just like, oh, I just wanted to dance. I didn't want them.
Yeah. Not only that, she also mentions how she couldn't really settle down because she had dreams and other mm-hmm. things she wanted to accomplish before settling down.
Yes, mm-hmm. and honestly, that is a theme throughout this book.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was, I read Jonesy, this story arc, also in singles, and towards the end of the book, we meet Jonesy's mom, and we learn all about why Jonesy's mom is not in the picture now, and what she is doing, and where she was, and why she left. And we'll get into that a little bit more, but the theme of women being independent and having goals of their own that are independent of men, mm-hmm. I think was just, I love it. I cannot mm-hmm. say enough how much we need those kinds of stories to be told for young girls to read.
Mm-hmm. And definitely, and what I really liked about it is that when Josie's mom, she's like, so, like, I had bigger dreams. I decided to come to the U.S., and I really love that because that was a lot of, like, what my mom did. She mm-hmm. she said she wasn't happy with staying in Guatemala, and mm-hmm. she was just all like, no, I got bigger things to do. I was, like, she wanted to do more. She didn't want to be stuck in one place, and so she came to the U.S., mm-hmm. and I really resonated with that because it's something that my mom has always told me, and I love seeing reflected in Jonesy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And we see Jonesy in the beginning. I mean, Jonesy's a teenager. At the end of the day, she's a teenager, and she mm-hmm. falls victim to teenage things, and in this case, her things is stuff.
Yeah. Her crush on stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And so we do see Jonesy in the beginning of the book kind of just ignoring her friends and breaking plans and breaking promises so mm-hmm. that she can go spend time with stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And who hasn't had a friend or been the friend who's done that in the past? And I think that seeing that portrayed in here, definitely realistic to, you know, mm-hmm. A young teenage girl's life, but also the way that Sam writes how she realizes that her friends are important and that, you know, and we see her kind of do her own little individual character development where she realizes. And the thing that I loved is what was it that Steph told her that she's just like, what did you say to me? And you can see that she gets so angry that he dared. He says, let's be real, Jonesy. It's not like there's not a million fans out there who would die to do this, and I wouldn't even have to beg. So get in the costume. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to make her do something that she doesn't want to do, and she's trying to share with him her ideas. She has really great ideas for this mm-hmm. space opera that he wants to put on. And when he tells her that, you see the look on her face, and she just says, what did you say? Mm-hmm. And she repeats it, what did you say? And she gets so angry. And I love that the way that she's written is that, yeah, she was, you know, quote unquote in love with him and stuff, but at the end of the day, she is her own person, and mm-hmm. she was not going to let anyone tell her what she could and couldn't do.
Yeah.
The famous Wonder Woman line, what I do is not up to you.
Yeah.
I also like the fact that whenever she had, like, she sought for advice, she always went to her grandmother, mm-hmm. and her grandmother would say, ay, mija, you know, why are you all into this boy?
Yeah.
Like, he has a cute butt, but it's...
I know.
Like, it's not really worth it. She's like, but if you're going to go down this path, you know, here's my dress.
Yeah.
But she kept telling her, like, I keep telling you, it's not about the boy.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And even, it's not something that's, it's sort of like covertly in the story, so it doesn't feel like it's snagging.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was going to say, I loved that she's not mincing words, telling her, look, you're kind of being a little bit silly. Why are you putting so much effort into this boy? Mm-hmm. But she's also not telling her what to do. She's mm-hmm. letting Jonesy make her own mistakes.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
exactly.
Mm-hmm. And that's the best way to learn, honestly. Like, mm-hmm. The whole, like, it's, a kid won't know that the stove is hot until he actually touches the stove.
Yes, pretty much. So we see a little bit of a resolution with Jonesy and her crush on Stuff, and mm-hmm. her realizing that she was being a little bit of a bad friend. And she, you know what I realized? Farid is a name, is one of Jonesy's friends, and it was also the son's name in Green Lantern.
Oh,
that's right. That's a good catch. Oh my God. I didn't realize that.
Headcanon Farid is actually that Farid, and later he's going to be best friends with the Jonesy.
So that is that's kind of and I love that you can tell that Farid has such a big crush on Jonesy.
Aww.
And she's yeah. kind of oblivious to it, I think, a little mm-hmm. bit. But the way that Sam wrote both of them, the same words that Jonesy was saying to Stuff mm-hmm. in her, like, lovey-dovey heart eyes are the same things that Farid was saying to Jonesy, because he was feeling those same things. But we see a little bit of a resolution there, and then we get to the part of the story where Jonesy's mom comes back into the picture, and we learn all about the fact that Jonesy's mom had decided that her mom and her dad just didn't work out. They got married young, and they became different people. Mm-hmm. And that's how she kind of she explained it to Jonesy. And she wanted to become a lawyer, and so she moved to the city, and she got an apartment and lived with, you know, five other people, and just had a student life. And I think that Jonesy, up until the point where her mom was explaining to her, really didn't know, because she was so young, what was going on. All she knew was that her mom was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that kind of, I love the fact that they were in mall jail. They were in mall jail when this touching moment goes down. And yeah. I love that how Nisha, the girl's like, I don't want to go to mall jail. She just kept saying that. Her and Susan kept saying that over and over again. And so I love those two and their relationship. We saw it come together in mm-hmm. issue or in volume one, but mm-hmm. the fact that, you know, they're still together, and they're so cute together.
They're adorable.
You know,
I love them. Yeah.
So I'm glad. I really like the portrayal of how Jonesy is just so angry at her mom.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
She even goes as far as to creating a story that she's an actual monster.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And her friends believe her.
Yeah, and they're so scared to meet her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They actually are just there to be with Jonesy, and they don't want to meet the mom.
Right.
Uh-huh. But then they hang out, and they find out she's really cool, and you find out that it's just she's having a grudge, because, like you said, all she knew was that she was gone.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. She's like, she abandoned us.
Uh-huh.
But then she goes on, and she tells her, no, like, I had bigger dreams, but these dreams were for us. They
yeah.
were for you.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, because we can do so much more. Now I have an apartment, uh-huh. and you can come down and visit me. There's a room for you. Like, I want you to see this as your home as well. I couldn't bring you before because I had five roommates.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But now I can. So I thought that was very touching. That
a very real moment.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because there's going to be mm-hmm. a parent who, if they separate, is going to be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And most likely the child will feel like they're abandoned, or mm-hmm. they walked
of course.
Away of the relationship.
Yeah.
So, again, the strong, independent female having dreams, going off and following them mm-hmm. Is a theme that we see, again, readdressed with Jonesy's mom. And we see Jonesy kind of coming to a aha moment that, you know, my mom did this for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I just loved the entire story arc of the mom and the relationship with the mom. I love the story arc of Jonesy kind of having her aha moment with Stuff and going back to hanging out with her friends. And I just cannot recommend this book enough to all of the people who come into the shop looking for an all-ages book.
Mm-hmm.
And even people who aren't. And they want something fun and kind of uplifting. And mm-hmm. And the story, I'm sorry, the artwork
is
like
amazing.
Yes, you cannot
love it.
Deny. And oh my gosh, the this here, the Natasha Bustos.
Oh, yeah.
The Natasha Bustos pinup that is in the back of the book is just It's more in the style of, like, not so much of a cartoonish Jonesy,
almost,
but like a...
Archie, the current Archie style.
Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, what does she's, Natasha is, Moon Girl Devil Dinosaur.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. You can see it.
Yeah, you can, oh,
you
can yeah,
see
you
it
can definitely
here.
See
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but, I love these different, guest, artist, yeah. Covers in the back. And I want to hunt down that Natasha Bustos. it's an issue 5 second print cover.
Nice.
So... anything you guys want to add about Jonesy Volume 2?
No, I'm definitely really a big fan of the art style.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that. It's really colorful in the way it comes out and how it actually highlights the story itself. I really, really enjoy. I'm a big fan. This is good stuff. And it also leaves you on a cliffhanger, just so you guys know.
Yes.
But it's great. It's great. I love it when she gets angry. That's one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
I love it when they're feeling emotion. It's just their face just kind of wrinkles in a sort of way. I love it.
So it looks like we might have been introduced to Jonesy's nemesis at the end of Volume 2.
Dun, dun, dun.
So yeah, definitely a cliffhanger, and I'm looking forward to finding more about this ominous stranger.
Yeah.
I definitely give Jonesy Volume 2 again 3 conchas, a campo chaparrado, and a little cochinita.
Same here. The entire panaderia, entire. I said that.
Entire.
That slipped out. I was trying to say something else, but then it came out like that. I'm not trying to be. but I gave it the entire panaderia and all the champurrado.
Yep.
Excellent. I as well. I give it la panaderia y el champurrado as well with the three.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's las tres conchas.
Awesome. Yes, pick up both these books, and volume 3 of both Green Lanterns and Jonesy will be out, both of them, in September.
Hey.
What is on my radar, guys?
So for me, on my radar, I feel like I have been seeing so many horror comic books coming out recently, and I love horror comics. And on my radar this week is The Unsound. It's Cullen Bunn book that is just so creepy, and like I love... I just love the art. The art is by Jack Cole, but the book itself is described. Ashley is a first. It's her first day as a nurse at Weirmont Psychiatric Hospital.
Ooh.
Now, just right there, and I'm already freaked out. and it turns into a nightmare as a bloody riot sends her fleeing into the bowels of the hospital.
Ooh.
Her descent takes her to a hellish world populated by lunatics and monsters, cloaked in a secret history of black magic and heinous scientific experiments. So I don't know if any of listeners or either you, Jen and Sarah, had seen the American Horror Story.
Yeah.
Where it was in the psychiatric hospital.
The American Horror Story Asylum.
Oh, my goodness. That was the creepiest shit. And mm-hmm. I just... And the thing is that stuff really happened. I mean, not the supernatural stuff, but all those psychiatric experiments and the way that they treated...
The maltreatment and everything. That's a real part of history, and
mm-hmm.
that's what always... freaks me out about those places.
Me too. So that right there, the setting of this comic book already hooked me. But mm-hmm. Cullen Bunn as a horror writer, to me, that is where his strength is. And it's on issue 3 right now, and I am loving it. It's getting weirder and creepier as the issues go by. So definitely on my radar, and I recommend that you check it out.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Definitely. Keeping up with the horror theme, this book just came out this week. Last week.
Mm-hmm.
And it is called Redlands. It is by Jordi Belair and Vanessa Del Rey, and it is published by Image. So it's a brand new horror book from the minds of Eisner Award winner Jordi Belair and critically acclaimed artist Vanessa Del Rey from Zero, Scarlet Witch, and Constantine, brings you to the sleepy, sunny town of Redlands, Florida. The police are failing to maintain control of their old-fashioned town, and a coven of killer witches plan to take everything from them this summer. Hide your Bibles.
I actually read issue one, and it was good.
Yeah, issue one, I absolutely love it. And I love Jordi Belair's colors. She is such an amazing color artist. She's done All-Star Batman. She's done she's done a lot of other titles. But this is co-created by her and by Vanessa Del Rey. So
okay.
It's I can't wait. I'm super excited for it, especially because I know Jordi Belair and Vanessa Del Rey have on Twitter. They post a lot of their works. And a lot of it has to do with, like, witches and covens. It has a very... Last episode, when I had said by chance or by providence, it has that kind of vibe to it, that kind of creepy, witchy vibe that I absolutely love. It's really good. I cannot recommend it enough. Only issue number one has come out. Issue number two comes out in about 2 weeks.
Yeah, and multicultural coven of witches. That's all you need to know.
Yep.
I love it. Well, on my radar, Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman. It's a biopic that's going to be coming out in 2017. Not any news on what date or month, but it's kind of the story about the creator of Wonder Woman, his wife, and his lover, who they, the wife and the lover, become lovers after his death. So you see kind of like the inspiration of Wonder Woman and where she came from in this biopic. Who knows if it's actually like, it must be based on true life, I'm thinking. But it's set like in the 1930s or so forth, so it's one of those period pieces, so that's on my radar. Yeah, I've heard actually a lot about this biopic, and definitely with the release of the Wonder Woman movie, a lot of that history and personal life of Dr. Marston came to the forefront, and his life was definitely really interesting.
Very interesting.
And the fact that he was polyamorous, and that one of his, not his wife, but his addition, I don't know what the correct his girlfriend term is to use, but the fact that she was, I believe, the niece of one of the forefront women who was started the feminist movement, and that was a lot of where his talks and meetings with her aunt is where he really got the idea of Wonder Woman, and then he kind of incorporated his kink into it, and there you go.
Nice.
Well, this movie is directed and written by Angela Robinson, so it's a female writer and director, so it's it's interesting. I have my it's on my radar, so I can't wait to watch it. See what's up with that.
Awesome. Yep.
Definitely. Okay, so we come to the segment of Juntos y Fuertes. As you may recall, listening to Comadres y Comics, Juntos y Fuertes is a segment where we show love and support for members of marginalized groups within the comic community. And on my Juntos y Fuertes radar, I really want to talk about an organization called Self-Help Graphics and Art. They are a nonprofit organization founded in 1970 that resides in the heart of Los Angeles. They're dedicated to the production, interpretation, and distribution of prints and other art media by Chicano, Chicana, Latino, Latino artists. They are amazing. They really do a lot of community outreach. They provide a lot of community programming, and one of the things that has started to come up because of the time of year it is their big Dia de los Muertos event that they have.
Oh, wow.
They already have it scheduled. It's November 4th this year, and they just open their doors to the community and offer free events and crafts. You can go in and make a sugar skull.
Ooh.
You can design a a silkscreen shirt. I don't know if you can design it, but you can make one. There's so many things that you can do there, and they really provide access to art and art classes to the community in East Los Angeles.
That's
so
wonderful.
Definitely, if you haven't heard of them, check them out. Their website is selfhelpgraphics.com. They do have a Facebook page, and they're always, every month, they have different community events. They have classes. Some of the things are free. Most of the things are, if they do have a cost, are very low cost, and I think they might even have some scholarships that are available. But the fact that they're just out there providing access and support for Latinx and Chicano creators and people who want to get into art, and also just a way to distribute art, is just, to me, amazing. So we should actually check them out and see if they have anything comic book related. Maybe we could do some kind of commodity comics and self-help graphic collaboration.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
So cool.
Yeah.
I like that idea.
And for my part of Juntos y Fuertes, I'm pretty sure everybody has at least heard of all the horrible things that have happened in Charlottesville. And a lot of comic book artists have spoken out. Comic book artists and creators have spoken out against the violence in Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, artist Jen St. Orange is selling an awesome Bombshells style Batwoman print to help raise money for the Albemarle Charlottesville NAACP.
Oh, okay.
So it has Batwoman in her DC Bombshells.
Yes, I love that. I would love to cosplay as Bombshell Batwoman.
Mm-hmm. And cool. It's really cool, and it says stand together, take no quarter. So it's if anybody wants to help out for what has happened and the tragedy at Charlottesville, this is a good way of getting it. You get a cool print from it, and you get to support the NAACP as they fight for civil rights. And that's it for me.
Absolutely. I think that's awesome. I'm looking at the picture on Jen's phone right now, and it's amazing. I want one.
I'll post it later on our Facebook.
As for my Juntos y Fuertes, I guess we've all come across internet bashing or bullying. In this instance, there's a fellow podcast that... it's in Spanish, and it's called El Tribunal de los Supergüeyes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long title, but it's pretty darn cool. El Tribunal de los Supergüeyes. They recently incorporated a young lady, Isa, to be part of their podcast, all-male podcast. They have a great big following in Mexico as well as in the U.S. They're really an amazing podcast. They're on their 200th episode.
Wow.
Yeah, and... they have a blog. I mean, these guys are they're really into their comic book stuff. I mean, they're really amazing, and I love to listen to them. But like I said, they recently incorporated a young girl, a young woman by the name of Isa, into their podcast, and immediately she started to get backlash.
Wow.
Oh my God. After the second episode she was in, it was like, you cannot be in there. Not them themselves, because they welcomed her in the podcast.
Absolutely.
But the audience themselves just went and just attacked her.
Oh, my gosh.
Even though she wasn't, like, full forward on the episodes, I mean, she had her opinions, but she wasn't cutting anyone off. And, she's a very knowledgeable young girl. They were just not having it.
Wow.
And she got attacked so bad that she posted on Facebook, "This is the first and last time I'm going to post. I am not into this. This is too much for me, and I'm going to be leaving the podcast."
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my God.
So after she posted that, immediately she started to get a lot of support. And again, there were those trolls who were being unsupportive and actually being really rude and mean.
Right.
She says she doesn't have very thick skin, and she there's something she cannot live with like in her life. She doesn't want the negativity, so she was on her way out. So... if you are Spanish speaking, and if you like comics, maybe take a listen to the last two episodes of El Tribunal de los Supergüeyes. They're on iTunes as well. And, you know, if you like her, support her. Go on their Facebook or go on their blog and just, you know, give her some words of encouragement, because I found her to be very pleasant.
Yeah.
I like the change they were going into. I like the way they were going into a new face of their podcast, because eventually things change. Not everything stays the same.
I mean, props to those men who saw it fit to include a woman into their podcast.
Exactly.
I mean, that is 50% of readership of comics is are women. So I think that it was awesome on their part to see the positivity of what adding a woman would to their podcast would bring. And I feel so horrible. And I feel so horrible to hear this story. And at the same time, I feel so angry that it doesn't shock me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And
same
that was
here.
One of the things that she did mention, because it was a long post, you know. I can't go over every single detail, but one of the things is, like, you know, being in Mexico and a Mexican woman, it's a real struggle.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, I deal with this on an everyday basis, and for now to deal with it on my social media is just too much for me. And I think towards the end she said, you know, it really sucks to kind of be born the wrong gender. And I'm like, you know what, here at Comadres y Comics, and I posted on her post, I said, here at Comadres y Comics, we understand how you feel. Be it walking into a comic book shop or having everything mansplained to us, you know, it sucks, and we're with you.
Yeah.
And we hope you stay. Because
I guess I missed the first part where you said that they were Mexico-based, so I can understand I can understand it just from a female perspective, but a female in a male-dominated industry in Mexico, I can totally see how that would just be so overwhelming.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and they weren't holding any punches.
Yeah.
I read some of the trolls that were on the feed, and I was just like, my goodness, really? You really had to put your two cents in, didn't
you?
Like, there was just some really awful stuff. There was this one guy who said, you know, I listen to this podcast because it's an all-male podcast, and it's like having drinks with the fellas. And for you to introduce a woman just, you know, screwed up my dynamic, and she just came to, like, salt the entire podcast. And I'm like, dude, really? Like, really? These are the friends you drink with? Maybe he should, like, find new friends and listen to another podcast, because podcasts are about evolution. They're about speaking your mind and about, you know, actually changing with the times as well.
Yeah.
So...
Well, I definitely want to give her as much support as we can, and if we can, if she's still on social media, if we can put any of her social media links up so that people can show their support, that would be great.
Absolutely, and I highly recommend the podcast anyway. They're really cool people.
Yeah.
Well, so that's on my Juntos y Fuertes.
Jumpin' Jehoshaphat! Today we have the great pleasure of hosting writer and comic creator extraordinaire Sam Humphries as a guest on Comadres y Comics. You may know Sam as the writer of two of the books we have reviewed here on our podcast, DC's Green Lanterns and Boom Studios' Jonesy. But he's been contributing to the industry, creating unique and compelling stories since 2011, beginning with his breakout self-published hit, Our Love is Real. With Marvel titles under his belt, including Star-Lord, Planet Hulk, and Avengers, he's also written Citizen Jack, an Image comic that has uncannily become a crystal ball predicting our current political administration and climate. Sam impressed Comadres y Comics with his portrayal of Latina characters Green Lantern Jessica Cruz and sassy title character Jonesy. We welcome Sam, a recent newlywed, to our show to discuss all the comic things and explain how one little piñata brought us together. Welcome, Sam, and thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Oh, well, good morning. Good Monday morning. We're really excited to have you as a guest today, and we can't wait to hear all the juicy details of all of your comic successes. But we would like for you to start by telling us a little bit about how you came to heard about Comadres y Comics and that famous piñata.
Oh, my God, the piñata, yes.
It was the weekend of the East Los Angeles Comic Convention, right? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, right. Correct.
Yes. So, people, you guys had the Jessica Cruz Pinata at your table, or you had it around on the floor or something?
Yeah, it was part of our table.
Yeah, so people were tweeting me photos of it, and at first I was like, my first reaction was like, I can't believe there's like an East Angeles convention happening. And I was really bummed. I was bummed to miss out. I was like, I failed. Like, I need to be like more up on what's going on. But then the pinata, I just thought was like so cool and so awesome. And of course, I had to like tweet it out and like show it off to everybody. And I don't know. I just thought it was so cool the way. I love like when people do like, you know, like custom action figures of Jessica, or they do cosplay of Jessica. But like doing the pinata was like so cool because it really encapsulated her Mexican American heritage. And like for people who are listening who are not in like Southern California, like pinata is like such an art form like down here and around here.
Yeah, absolutely.
That, like, yeah, it's like an honor, or you know, sometimes a dishonor to become be made into. You know, so depending on the depiction, in this case, definitely like a huge honor. And yeah, I was just so flattered that somebody made a Jessica Cruz pinata, and then you guys hit me back and said hi, and I clicked through and I checked out the podcast, and I was just like, these guys are awesome. They're kicking ass. So thank you for having me on the show. I'm psyched.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah.
And then, of course, you sent me a pinata, a Jessica Cruz pinata of my own. Thank you very much. She is hanging in the office, like, not 4 feet from me, starting to watch this podcast. So thank you again for this pinata. She is amazing.
I think you're absolutely right that pinata making is an art form, and I really mm-hmm. just have to give all the credit to Sarah. She was just, when she brought that pinata to the East LA Comic Con, both Jen and I were just blown away at just the,
yeah,
the depiction of it.
Yeah, we knew she was going to make one.
Yeah,
but.
And everybody walking by the table, that was like, it was definitely a big highlight of of the East LA Comic Con, and everybody coming to our table had nothing but amazing things to say about Sarah and her artistry.
Heck yeah. Good job, Sarah.
Oh,
like,
thanks, guys.
That.
Thanks so much. Yes. It was such a pleasure to work on, you know, a Mexican-American character, especially comic book related. I'm really big on the comic book thing, so.
Yeah, the second I saw the photo, I just, like, it's so perfect in so many ways. So, well done.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Comadres y Comics was created, this is again Sarah, Comadres y Comics was created with the goal of highlighting Latinx characters, creators, and fans in order to promote diversity and representation in comics. Do you feel you have a responsibility to include diversity in your stories? What do you find most challenging about including diverse characters into your stories?
It's a couple things. One, I do feel a responsibility to make sure that my stories are diverse. One, because the comics field or comic stories have both been so heavily straight, white, and male for so long that, like, I think it's clear that there needs to be a rebalancing of what we see on the page and behind the page. But also, like, I mean, it's a responsibility, but it's also something that, like, when I'm writing a story that happens to be diverse, it just feels more real and truthful and authentic to me. And so I hope, like, when, that's kind of the goal. Like, if it feels true to you, then hopefully it'll feel true to the audience. And to write something that wasn't diverse just wouldn't feel real and true and authentic to me. So it's a responsibility, but it's also like just the kind of story that I prefer. It's the kind of story that just feels right for me to do. In terms of like challenging, you know, it's not challenging to write diverse characters. I think Kelly Sue, so I'm going to like mangle something that Kelly Sue says a lot, which is like, you know, you'll have like, you have these like male writers who are like, I don't understand how to write like women characters, but at the same time they're writing like aliens with like five heads and shit out there.
Yeah.
It doesn't take, you know, especially if you're writing like science fiction, fantasy, or superheroes or whatever, it doesn't take that much more imagination to write an actual human on Earth with the same kind of, like, concerns that you have, you know, about, like, family or friends or the future ambition or whatever, if you're already writing, like, just a talk and all that kind of stuff. So I think that maybe the biggest challenge I have is, one, you want to make sure that you're doing it right, and you want to make sure that if you're straying into some sensitive territory, that you're doing it right in relation to the characters that you're writing. But also, at least for me, being a straight white dude doing this, like, I always want to check myself and make sure that I'm not trying to write, like, in Jonesy, like, I'm not trying to write a story that encapsulates what it's like for Latinas in America.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As much as I feel like that's, like, such a great and vital story that needs to be told in comics, I am, like, the last person to be telling that story. So it's sort of, like, just making sure that I'm not stepping over, like, actual Latinas who are out there trying to tell their story. That's a story for somebody else to tell and not for me. As much as I see those elements in the world and think, like, God, this needs to be addressed and needs to be said, like, I'm just not the one to say it.
Well, I think you're doing beautifully. I really enjoy Jonesy. And I know the girls here enjoy her, too. She's amazing.
She's super
thank
cute.
So
I love
much.
Her.
And I think what you said about just writing stories that reflect what's around in your world and that resonate with what's going on and what your experiences are is very close to, I think, some things that Stan Lee has said in the past when he has experienced pushback from including diversity into his books. He's just basically saying the comics should reflect the real world, and if this stuff is going on in the real world, why shouldn't it be going on in comics? So I think that is... you saying that is definitely reflected in the stories that you read. And with regards to both Green Lanterns and Jonesy, when we reviewed both of them, even though you're saying that that wasn't necessarily your main goal, both books, the Latina aspect of both Jessica Cruz and Jonesy, a lot of the writing that you did resonated with us on a level of being able to identify with her as a Latina.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and so we really are kind of interested, you kind of touched about on it a little bit in the previous question, but what is your process in really trying to stay true to a character's culture and ethnicity when you're developing stories?
It's like, it's difficult to encapsulate, but it's so important to make sure you're always keeping in the back of your head, because there's definitely a line if you don't belong to the culture, because you want people of that culture to be able to relate to the character and to be able to, like, own them and to feel some, like, some pride in them and be like, man, like, here's like an actual, like this Mexican-American character feels Mexican-American to me, you know what I mean? Like, you're not playing it so safe or so down the middle that they just feel like could be any other character from any other culture. I guess, like, I mean, part of it for me is that I've been in Los Angeles for almost 20 years. And this is like Mexican territory, you know? Like, it's now, but it used to be Mexican.
Right.
Right on the border with Mexico, and people from Mexico and Central America and Asia and all over the world are just part of the fabric of Los Angeles. And you can't have Los Angeles without people from all over the place. And you really can't live here and not absorb Mexican culture unless you're, like, really got your head stuck up your ass. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just in the normal course of my life here in Los Angeles, I've made so many friends who are Mexican-American or first-generation Mexican-American or from Mexico, I've been down to Mexico. So, I think as a writer, any writer, like, no matter where you are, like, you just have your eyes and your ears open and you just listen to things that kind of, like, strike you as compelling, but also true, like things just that just feel true, even if they aren't your own personal immediate reality. So I think a lot of what I do right, if I do anything right with Jessica Cruz and Jones, comes from Los Angeles and the friends I've made here and the people I've known here over the years. But then you also really do have to do like the actual research, getting online and asking specific questions about, you know, Mexican American history or the experience of Mexican Americans and some things that you can never know, no matter how many friends you may have who may have that experience. They're just things that you will never know firsthand, and so you really have to double down on the work and make sure that you're doing things right. You're not saying that something that has like dangerous or terrible implications, and then you have to put some like real thought into it and put your ego aside and be like, God, like, even though this scene that I envisioned is really cool, like, this is kind of dicey, like, kind of a dicey thing to put a Mexican American person through, even on the page. And you got to be like, you know, the right thing to do is to get rid of this scene, like, just cut it out and go a different direction and figure something else out. You really have to like do the hard work of being candid and honest when it's just you and the page in front of you.
I love that. That's really inspiring. I like that you say you have to put in the work. In order, you know, a lot of us, I say a lot of us because I do that too, where,
yeah.
where you sort of like, you kind of buy a set of pencils and you're like, I'm going to be a great artist because I've bought the best pencils. Mm-hmm. But that's not the case. You have to do the work. So I'm glad you pointed that out.
Is this a call out, Sarah? No, no, I'm just kidding. At one point, I wanted to like draw, and I was just like, I'm gonna try and practice, but I never got around to it. The best I can do is stick figures.
I just bought a box of colored pencils last night, but I'm only getting ready to do color by numbers.
But you'll get there. Baby steps, right?
Baby steps.
Yeah.
So definitely you mentioning Los Angeles being a melting pot is so true, and anybody that lives in LA who doesn't appreciate just all the different cultures they have access here to in our city, I think is just missing out on so much of what the city has to offer.
Like you're not just like stupid, but you're actually like harming yourself.
Right.
Like, you're
absolutely
really playing yourself. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead,
definitely.
If anything, just all the awesome food that you can be eating.
Oh, my God.
I know.
Where else am I going to get Armenian food? The Midwest? Like, no. Like.
Yes. I have made my husband promise that he will not make me move anywhere that does not have a shabu-shabu restaurant. And Sam, if you've never eaten shabu-shabu, that's my favorite ever.
I tell you, I grew up in Minnesota, so, like, I know, like, the Midwest. I grew up, you're not going to believe this, but, like, I grew up, my only Mexican restaurant, do you guys know what a Chi-Chi's is?
No.
Chi-Chi's is like Olive Garden, but for Mexican food.
Oh!
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Is it?
Wow.
That was, like, my only Mexican food, and it was terrible. And, of course, like, the second I moved out to Los Angeles, I was like,
Chi-Chi also means breast in Spanish.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. It's kind of like a slang term.
Yeah. No. Oh, my God.
It's like, this is Sarah, it's like boobies, Chi-Chi's. Yeah.
Uh-huh. I mean, I know it's also used as like a nickname for some people, but the Chi-Chi's is like slang for her boobs.
No, I swear to you, it's a fucking chain restaurant. I used to go to Chi-Chi's with my family.
That's awesome. That sentence is the most awesome sentence we're going to have in this whole interview.
Dude, I can't even believe that. I'm Googling this right now.
You know, you said Chi-Chi's, and I'm like, maybe it was something else. They can't name a restaurant Boobies.
I'm looking at it right now. I'm looking at, like, the menu and everything on Google.
Oh, that's funny. Well, we've talked about a little bit of about how you include representation, but the flip side of that is access. And, like, we've talked about the fact that there are so many different cultures and Los Angeles is so diverse, as is the nation. Can you talk a little bit about access to comics, the comics that you write, the comics that you create? What have you done in your career, or how do you encourage access to your work to marginalized groups?
God, that's such a great question, and the answer is, like, probably not enough. Like, I probably just don't do enough, and I never really thought about it that way. Like, I thought about diversity, like, on the page, and I thought about diversity behind the scenes, but in terms of how to actually, the access of the comics to marginalized people is something that I've thought about, but never quite crystallized in that way. I think that's such a great question. I think it's so important, especially because we have such, as you guys know, we have such a crazy, like, almost abusive relationship with distribution.
My God, yeah. Every Tuesday.
Diamond is my mortal enemy.
Yeah, you guys know over at Heidi Hill Comics.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you guys deal with it every week. And you guys know, I'm sure you probably had this experience yourselves firsthand, just how stores can be, how unwelcoming stores can be to various marginalized people, or not, quote, you know, people who are, quote unquote, not a typical comics reader, whatever that fucking means. But it's tough, you know. Sometimes you feel like it's, you know, fighting against that distribution problem in general is just like pushing a rock uphill, and you push it up an inch and it rolls back 2 feet. But it's something that I, at least when I, you know, I just try to be welcoming to everybody in comics, whether it's on Twitter or it's at a show or a signing or something like that. Like, I, like, whoever comes, like, I don't care who you are, you know, you got love for comics, and I don't even care if you've loved comics for 20 years or 20 minutes, I don't care. As long as you're there out of love, like, I'm happy you're there, and I'm happy to see you. That's a great question. That's a question I'll be thinking about a lot after we're done talking.
Well, I have to say that we took both Green Lanterns and Jonesy to our table display when we went to the East LA Comic-Con, and we told all the people that stopped at our table about how each of those books included a Latino character, and so many of the people who came to East LA Comic-Con were not your quote-unquote normal expected comic book reader. In fact, most of them had never even picked up a comic book in their life, but were so excited and interested in reading a comic book, and so freaking happy to know that there were comic books out there that had representation of themselves in them. And so definitely we saw, what we learned that day was that Latinos are hungry to read comics, and we were so excited and happy to see that.
One of the things I also noticed at East LA Comic-Con, this is Sarah, was a lot of families brought their kids and so forth, and some of the kids had already read Jonesy or those for young readers. So that was really great that the schools or some of the teachers may have been comic book fans and are kind of passing it on to their students.
Yeah. You know, Jonesy has been a book that for whatever reason, has found a lot of support through librarians, which I fucking love. I'm sorry, can I swear on this one?
Swear all the time.
Okay, good. I just realized I probably, like, put the F-bomb, like, 12 times. I love libraries. I love librarians. I love the support we get from libraries. So I always try to, like, help them out or even just retweet them or whatever. I did a talk at the North Hollywood Library up here, which is, like, super cool. But yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think these comics, they gotta get out into the community more, you know. They gotta get out more where the people are, not just not just in the same circles that we travel in over and over again.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have Heidi Ho has a really strong relationship with our local library, given that it's literally around the corner. And we co-hosted Free Comic Book Day this year, and it was so successful. And so I just loved seeing all the new people coming into the shop and taking away all those comic books. And definitely libraries and school librarians are all people I think that is just right now starting. The comic book industry may just be starting to recognize and realize that, hey, this is a way to really get more fans into reading comics, and I really hope that that continues to grow.
Amen.
So this is Jen, and we've discussed diversity on the page, but diversity and representation of creators is also important. In your opinion, how could the comic book industry facilitate the growth of members of marginalized groups as writers and artists? What is your advice for these groups to enter the industry?
This is another awesome question, because I try to say as much as possible that, like, comic books are not truly diverse until they have diversity on the page and behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. You have to have both. You can't just have people like me, like straight white dudes writing Mexican Americans, and think you have true diversity. Like, you also need Mexican Americans and all sorts of other marginalized people actually telling stories as well. And speaking from their point of view, and speaking from, you know, their experience. And studies have shown in other industries, in television and movies, that even on just like the most crass, mercenary, capitalistic level, that when you have shows that have diversity in the writing room, that you have shows that are, on the whole, on average, more successful.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So, I think the comic book industry needs to pay attention to that, because it really likes making money. But you do need people from all sorts of groups, all sorts of walks of life, being able to tell their truth from their perspective, and not filtered through people like me, who can do, you know, I can do a pretty good job with a Jonesy or whatever, but it's not the same as an actual Latina person telling their experience. I think the industry does need to take very tangible steps towards welcoming marginalized creators, because mm-hmm. for so long those marginalized creators have not been welcome,
mm-hmm.
or at the very least it is clear that they have not felt welcome, which is basically the same thing. So I think there has been some confusion on the industry side, because it has, you know, some publishers will feel like, hey, please, we welcome all sorts of diverse creators now. And then they kind of, you know, the next day they're like, well, we said we welcome diverse creators, but where are they? Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes there's a lack of understanding that, yes, yesterday you said that these creators are welcome, but for weeks, months, years in the past, they have felt unwelcome. And they have felt unwelcome not because you are a person, you know, marching the street with a swastika, but because you have done small things, maybe imperceptible things, that have made marginalized creators feel unwelcome. And if you mm-hmm. have a marginalized creator who is a writer or an artist, and they see something like, you know, maybe they love comics and all they want to do with their lives is make comics, and they see how unwelcoming the comic industry is to somebody like them, yeah, of course they're going to, like, take their talents and go elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. So absolutely.
Definitely.
I think the comic industry has some work to do on the industry side to correct some of the mistakes of the past, and to encourage marginalized people who are out there who have the talent, to encourage them and let them know that if they spend their time and the talent and energies in comics, it won't be a waste. They won't get to the front door and be turned away just because of who they are. That they will get to the front door and they will be welcome. They will be given opportunities to tell stories. So to that end, I think you have to do more to encourage those creators than you would just by you need to do more that are in ways specific to marginalized creators and not just do things that you would just do for anyone or in the normal course of your day. Mm-hmm. I do know that the DC Comics talent program, the past two classes have been pretty diverse. I don't know what has gone into those decisions, but the results have been pretty diverse. I think that is a good example of mm-hmm. how you can specifically be welcome to marginalized creators, but beyond that, there's still a lot of work to do. So I think it comes down to, if you want diversity behind the page, you are going to have to, it goes back to what we were saying before, you are going to have to put in the work and not just open the doors.
It's true, and especially we've seen like a rise of more people of color writing, like Ta-Nehisi Coates, Gabby Rivera, Roxane Gay when she was doing World of Wakanda. But on the flip side, stuff like Marvel did—they did cancel Black Panther and Crew before the second issue even dropped,
and
they ended World of Wakanda. So it seems that they want to, but at the same time, there's
maybe so, don't know how.
Yeah, don't know how, and self-sabotaging themselves as well. Because that, what you just told me about the DC, what is it, a writing class?
Mm-hmm. The writer's program. I forget the actual proper name, but yeah.
Uh-huh, like that in itself is pretty cool. I didn't even know that existed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But this is something that I've seen online as well, is that when they try, most industry groups like DC or Marvel try to create works with people of color behind them, they choose already prominent names, like Ta-Nehisi mm-hmm. Coates, who's well known in the academic world.
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
but they don't go out for actual, like,
unknowns.
Yeah. And that seems to be, like, one of the big factors into how they don't keep adding to the pool. They just choose the best of the best and say, oh, call it well and done.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. And, like, there's no shortage. You know, it frustrates me, and I hear this less and less, but it frustrates me when publishers or editors or whoever really is like, oh, we would love to hire a marginalized creator, but where are they? It's like, oh, what do you mean, where are they? And, like, there's so many of them out there doing the work, like, they're doing webcomics. They're
absolutely
doing, you know, they're doing all sorts of stuff. Just because they're not doing something that falls within sort of like a prescribed range of what you're still looking at for mm-hmm. up and coming creators, doesn't mean they're not out there doing the work. So again, like it's going to involve mm-hmm. taking some extra steps, doing some specific work to get out there and get those creators.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And also, like, let's just not lose another generation of, like, talented creators to other industries, because they will get paid elsewhere, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, someone wants to hear those stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I think it's interesting, too, a lot of the things that you talked about with widening the marginalized groups as the creator of a comic book can also, there are also parallels in just creating access in comic book shops. Absolutely. My own negative experiences of just being a woman walking into comic book shops has really guided me as a comic store owner in how I not only treat people coming into the door, but also just make the shop look appealing and inviting to all types of people. And I really hope to see and wish to see a lot more of that in other comic book shops as well, because I still hear, you know, people saying I didn't go into a comic book shop because it just felt so uncomfortable for me. So
yeah.
I really hope to see more of that kind of stuff going on, not only within the industry as creators, but also in the retail side of it too.
Definitely.
Absolutely, 100%.
So this is still Jen, and you touched upon like self-published works and web and web artists. So you yourself originally started with Our Love Is Real, and We've ordered some for the store.
Oh my gosh! When I started doing my research on my Sam Humphries interview, and I'm reading about your self-published work, and then I'm reading, oh, Our Love Is Real, and then I start reading the summary, I'm like, I literally was like, holy fuck. Who? Why have I never heard of this before, and why am I not reading it right now? Oh my God.
We're very excited to pick that up. And shortly after that, you were picked up by Image, and it was recreated, republished.
That's correct,
much.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That is very cool, and we have a question from a listener who wants to know, how long did it take from being a self-published comic creator to working for a major company, and do you have any advice on how to facilitate that move?
Yeah, I mean, God, I can only, you know... It's tough because I did Our Love Is Real, and I think I did Our Love Is Real in June of 2011. I might be off by.
That's what my sources say.
Yeah. Thank you. I was a journalist on the line here, yeah. 2011, in June of 2011, and then I think my first Marvel comic came out in... like January of 2012, maybe March of 2012.
I believe it.
I was writing it by December.
Uncanny X-Force or something? Or Uncanny X-Men?
No, John Carter, Gods of Mars.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But that is a really, like, on the face of it, is like a really deceptive timeline, because before I self-published Our Love Is Real, like, I was doing the work behind the scenes when I was just, you know, when I was a nobody, essentially. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're somebody to somebody, of course.
Yeah. You know,
like, as far as, like, the industry was concerned, I was just a nobody. I had done, like, all sorts of pitching. I'd done all sorts of networking. I had, like, at least 10 or 12 pitches out there that had gotten turned down. They just kind of, like, go on the merry-go-round from publisher to publisher, so each one got turned down, like, more than once. or, you know, even more frustrating is sometimes you just don't get a response sometimes. And that's just because people are busy, you know, they got other stuff
to do.
You
just described internet dating.
Okay. But, you know, my point is that by the time Our Love Is Real hit, I had done a lot of legwork to set the stage for myself, I guess you'd say, you know? So by the time Our Love Is Real came out, I was known to some editors. Mm. I had some relationships with editors. I did have two short stories published. One was a Fraggle Rock short story.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, from Fraggle Rock to Our Love Is Real, right? I did Fraggle Rock, and I did a short story. Boom Studios did a CBGB anthology about
the
New York Club.
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun. And in the issue I was in, Jaime Hernandez did the cover.
Nice.
Yes, and he's my absolute favorite, so that was huge. But to the industry, I was basically a nobody, and I just knew that by the way of this way comic book production cycles would run, that I was about to have like a dead year in the first year of my career, and that I probably wouldn't be able to recover from that. Like, what little momentum I would have had would have died, and I probably would have had to gone back to having a full-time job by that point anyway. And it was like kind of like, this is it. Like, there will be no other chances. And if my comic book career is going to go down in flames, I'm going to make the biggest fireball possible. So here comes a story about a cop and his dog, and... you know, basically, at the beginning of the year, I was like, I'm going to self-publish my books this year. Like, if nobody else, I'm not going to wait for anybody else's permission. I'm going to self-publish my books if I have to. Because when I was after I transitioned, like, out of superheroes and I was in, like, high school and college, this was, like, the 90s, there was, like, a very strong tradition of self-publishing, and some of my favorite creators back then were self-publishing, like David Lapham was doing Straight Bullets and Death
Phone. Oh, yeah.
And, like, it's funny because you say self-publishing in any other industry, mm-hmm. and people are like, oh, you mean like vanity press? Like nobody else would get you? You know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah. Comics.
But in comics, it's like a real, like, iconoclastic thing to do. Like, if you self-publish, mm-hmm. like, you're taking the bull by the horns, you're taking control of your own destiny, mm-hmm. you know, you're cutting out the middleman, blah, blah, blah. And sort of that whole vibe came from, came from their progenitors as well, but was definitely alive in the 90s, and that really, like, had an effect on me, so, and Love and Rockets was initially self-published
right,
as well.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So, I was like, if nothing happens this year, 20 years from now, 40 years from now, I just want to be able to look back and say I did everything.
Yeah.
Like, I left it all on the table. I don't want to go back and be like, man, if I had the guts to self-publish, then maybe something would have happened. Or if I had heeded the words of my ancestors, then maybe something would have happened, you know. So I went through all my pitches, and I threw them all away except for two that I felt were, like, so distinctive that if I didn't make them, then nobody would ever make them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like, some books, you see them, and it's kind of just like spinning the wheel of concepts, and it's like Die Hard at SeaWorld. Or
they just take the nearest ideas and fuse them.
I mean, God bless those books, but like somebody's eventually going to come up with those if you don't do it. So mm-hmm. Our Love is Real and Sacrifice were the two books I decided to self-publish. And, you know, I do want to say that it wasn't even like a political thing or a fuck you thing, because while Stephen Sanders was drawing Our Love is Real and Dalton Rose is drawing Sacrifice, like, I was still pitching them to publish. But mm-hmm. the tone was different, you know? Because it went from being like, please let me do this, to mm-hmm. I'm doing this no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This train is leaving the station no matter what. If you want to be on board, awesome, we'd love to have you. But I'm doing this anyway.
Yeah.
So I published Our Love is Real, and because of its very interesting concept, it really did. We were talking about distribution earlier, and not only did I self-publish it, but I self-distributed it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I was able to do Beyonce drop before Beyonce did it. I'm sure she took the inspiration from Our Love is Real. I didn't tell anyone. I was like, anything was happening until like 3 days before it came out, and I had only published 300 copies because that's all I could do, and it was only in 8 stores, and it was on Comixology, and that was about it.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And the day before it actually released, people were selling it on eBay for $150.
Oh my goodness!
Whoa.
What?
Yeah.
Talk about making it big.
I didn't see that money.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm like, did you see that money? No.
No.
It was total speculator. You know,
right,
people
yeah.
just thinking like, oh, there's only 300 copies, and calling up retailers and being like, oh, I want 5. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
It was just like but it was still like, it became like a big deal out of nowhere, and I had sent copies to the editors that I knew, and you know, the day it came out, it was immediately sold out. We went back to the second printing, and Eric from Image reached out and was basically like, congratulations, like, you did it, like,
wow.
You know, because I talked to him about Our Love is Real, and he just like wasn't quite sure, and he's like, you did what you said you were going to do, like, good work. And mm-hmm. he's like, It sounds like you have a huge demand. Like, how can we help you? And I was like, thank God.
God bless Image. I wouldn't see half the stories I'm reading if it wasn't for them.
That's so true.
Yeah, exactly. So they reprinted it and did it through Diamond, so any store could have it, which is great, just because, you know, the access was out there. And the same thing happened with Sacrifice, where we did Sacrifice, and I kept selling out. I self-distributed that, too, only that was in more like 80 stores, which was, or 60 stores, and that was a lot of time at the post office. And then Dark Horse did the same thing. Did a similar thing where they're like, "Congratulations, like you did it. The book is great. You know, what can we do to help? Would you like us to do a hardcover?" So Dark Horse now has all Sacrifice published in a beautiful hardcover edition.
Yes, I saw that hardcover. It's very lovely. I've ordered some for the store. So that's another one that I can't wait to read. But it looks very beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, Dark Horse, they just do amazing work. So
yeah, they do.
But then they asked, it was a no-brainer for us. Also, I was sick of being at the post office.
Well, Jen and I are super excited to get our hands on our very own copies of Our Love Is Real. Mm-hmm. You cannot imagine how excited we are.
Oh, my God.
When it comes in, reviews will be posted.
I cannot wait. You gotta tell me.
Well, I'm really excited that you said that, like, you got some of your inspiration from Love and Rockets and how they self-published. So that was so cool, like, keeping it real, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's really awesome.
Love and Rockets is by far my favorite comic of all time.
Maggie the Mechanic is the very first comic that Comadre Comics reviewed on our very first episode.
I love it. You guys kick it off in a big way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're leaving it all on the table.
Exactly. That's how you gotta do it. Oh, so, I'm sorry, a little question came from the listener. I mean, like, I think what you gotta do is, you know, a lot of people think that they are gonna pitch directly to Marvel and DC and get hired by Marvel and DC, and with the exception of, like, the DC Writers Program or something specific like that, what you gotta do is you gotta get your own work out there, whether it's self-publishing or it's webcomics or you work for a smaller publisher or whatever. Just know that, you know, Marvel and DC are like Major League Baseball, and you got to put in your time in the farm league and stuff.
Yep.
And there's no better way to prove to a big company that you can do the job than to actually do the job and hand them a comic. You
right.
know, like
mm-hmm. yeah,
that it's like proof. Like the proof is in your hands. Like you can see the work that I do. And then frankly, that's how they saw Our Love Is Real and Sacrifice. They're like, oh, you can do this. All right, well, let's give you a shot.
Nice. Well, I'll have to tell you that my husband will be very sad that you didn't have a magic formula for him to follow. This was his question. He's doing what you're saying. He has a webcomic, and he has self-published some books. And he actually told me to tell you that he would like to send you copies of Collectors. Collectors is a kind of loosely based on our marriage. It's all about Eddie, who is a comic book collector who loves his wife and his comic book collection, but not always necessarily in that order. And he said he'd love to send them to you as a wedding gift, and he thinks that your wife will definitely appreciate the humor.
Oh, my God. He totally will. That is very sweet of him. Tell him I said thank you. And yes, I would love to have them. That'd be fantastic.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That is so cool. You know, you were talking about Image and about your comics and self-publishing. When was the moment that you actually realized I've made it? That one singular moment when you look back and you're like, I made it.
God, it's a tough one because I'm I wouldn't say I'm naturally suspicious, but I just know that a lot of things can happen. So, like, the joke I always tell is, like, I don't believe that a comic is going to happen, like a new comic is going to happen, until I'm holding it in my hands. Mm-hmm. And even then, sometimes I'm not sure it's real. Like, even then, I'm not sure.
Just so, I'm sorry to cut you off, but just so you know, that's how we felt about this interview.
Yeah.
it's not real until it's happening. So it's happening.
As I told them, like, if I suddenly choke up, it's because I finally realized that this is happening.
And I was like, a week ago, I'm like, I'm already sweating.
She thought I wasn't going to come through.
No, I just get nervous. This is Sarah. This is normal me. I just start sweating.
So I think it was, I mean, it's just a very slow realization. And I mean, like, a lot of days I'm just like, I'm frustrated and I can't figure out how to, like, finish a script or whatever. And I don't feel like I've made it. You know, I still feel like I'm struggling. But one really cool moment that happened was early on, and I certainly didn't feel like I had made it yet, but it was a huge moment, was I was talking about how I sent Our Love is Real to some editors that I knew, and one of those editors was Stephen Wacker at Marvel, who used to be Marvel Publishing, and now he works at Marvel West Coast. And he and I had talked a bunch, and he let me pitch a couple times, and I really went through, and I sent him Our Love is Real, and he sent me an email and said, I just read Our Love is Real, congratulations, you did it, send me your phone number. So I was like, oh, thanks for reading, you know, here's my phone number. And 20 minutes later, the phone rang, and it was Axel Alonso, the editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics.
Nice.
Wow.
Yeah, and he goes, hey, I just read Our Love is Real. I thought it was great, one of my favorite comics of the year, and I just wanted to call you up and ask and see if you want to get in the mix here at Marvel.
Nice.
That's awesome.
And I said, before I answer, I just have to confirm, did you actually read Our Love is Real? Do you know what you're getting into? He said, yes, and we it was just like, you know, I was just on cloud nine. I was talking to Axel, and we were talking about, like, next steps for me to get into Marvel, and we chit-chat a little bit, and he said, we'll talk soon, goodbye. And the coolest part of that was that my little sister happened to be visiting me from Minnesota.
Aww.
And was, like, right there, like, in the apartment with me that day. And so it was, like, it was an amazing moment, but it was an amazing moment to share with my little sister, you know?
Yeah.
Just, like, she could, like, see me on the phone, and, like, I got off the phone, and we were running around the apartment. So that was, like, I mean, even just a phone call enough would be alone, but having my sister there was awesome. So that was a really cool moment for me.
That's so cool. That's a very tender moment. I thought maybe you guys were holding each other sobbing. That's what I would do.
So, this is Jen again, and you've been fortunate to work with many different publishers throughout your career. Working with DC, Marvel, Image, and Boom, what are the differences, if any, you find between them from a creator standpoint, and who do you prefer?
You know, I was going to ask the same thing.
I'm sorry, can I say that again?
I said, who do you prefer working with better, DC, Marvel, Image, or Boom?
Yeah. Who do I prefer?
Who prefer? And also, like, what are the differences working between the different publishers? And if there's, like, a major one? Like, I know from a lot of the history of comics that DC and Marvel sometimes work the same, but sometimes they work radically different.
Y'all are trying to get me in trouble.
I know. Asking the real questions.
Yeah.
You can plead the fifth on that one.
That's a good question, because there are definitely some differences. You know, I would say that Marvel and DC definitely have their differences from each other, but they're a lot more similar to each other than they are to a Boom or an Image. Especially if just for the purpose of this conversation, you know, Boom does a lot of, they do some work for higher stuff, whether it's like Adventure Time or Planet of the Apes, but I've only done creator owned with them, or mostly done creator owned with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost a question of what's the difference between work for hire, which is when you're just a freelancer working on something like Batman or Conan or Adventure Time, you know, property somebody else owns.
Mm-hmm.
The difference between that and doing creator-owned, which is where you create or co-create a brand new creation that you control and you own. And examples of that would be Hellboy, Walking Dead, or Jonesy.
Mm-hmm.
So they really are fundamentally different business models. And even if you like put the comics side by side, especially to a layperson, like they wouldn't be able to tell you the difference. Behind the scenes, there are a lot of differences about how you would approach them, what their working relationships are like, what level of I don't know about creative freedom necessarily. A lot of people say like there's a lot more creative freedom in creator-owned comics, and I take that point. There certainly is. Mm-hmm. I've found that there's just as much creative frustration in creator-owned as there is work for hire. Mm-hmm. It's just a different sort, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You still struggle with a lot of the same things as you would in work for hire, you know, staying true to your characters and what feels like an authentic truth and what's exciting and also, shit, I only got 20 pages to tell the story and I need to do it. Like, how am I going to do it?
Yeah.
But, you know, I would say that work for hire, creator-owned can sometimes feel more like an entrepreneurial situation or an entrepreneurial spirit, because and the situations can differ, but you and your co-creators can really run the show.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, you know, like Jonesy, but Jonesy, my co-creator is Caitlin Rose Boyle, who is amazing. She's a fantastic artist and
oh,
a
yes,
wonderful
co-creator.
Yeah,
we love her. Her artwork is
yes.
so cute.
She's moving to Los Angeles.
Oh, nice.
Yes. I'm so excited. She came out to visit maybe a month or two ago and did a lot of like interviews and like hanging out and stuff. And she's mm-hmm. moving out next month, so I could not be. I'm very excited. Very excited
Ooh,
to be here with
you
us.
You inadvertently gave us some cheese mix.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Let me tell you, soy un chismoso. I gotta tell you guys, when you sent me the list of questions, it included Chisme de la Semana. I got excited because chisme is one word I definitely know. Because my wife works with so many Spanish people a lot of Spanish slang is just flowed into
yeah.
our
yeah.
So, like, chisme is a word that we use around here a lot. Jonesy, I really just had a paragraph. I just had the core idea, and I knew that whoever was going to draw, whoever was going to have such a big hand in co-creating with me, that I kind of only had a paragraph for maybe like a whole year,
mm-hmm.
for a whole year of doing it, and I just waited until I had a co-creator, and then I didn't want to get it too far developed until a co-creator was involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad I didn't, because when Kayla and I first started working together, we just had a bunch of Google Docs that we would edit together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we would have, like, each of us would have, like, a different font color, and it would almost look like text messaging or like an iMessage. Because it'd be like, each of us would be like, does Jonesy have any tattoos or whatever? Mm-hmm. What's Jonesy's favorite cereal? Or what does Jonesy need? You know, like that kind of stuff. And we just, like, go back and forth on it. So that's one thing that I love about creator-owned comics, is you can really create something from the ground up
mm-hmm.
with a co-creator. And to me, that relationship is really special and really valuable. And in my experience, the tighter that collaboration is and the tighter that relationship is, the better the comics are.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm kind of glad you touched on co-creating a character, and that was one of my questions, was like, what's the relationship like between a writer and an artist, and how to project that idea into the paneling, and how hard is it to work alongside somebody else? I mean, I know you touched on it by being the co-creator for Jonesy, and another thing was that, you know, I want to know is that who do you long to work with as an artist? I guess it's many questions in one.
Oh, my God, yeah. Boy. Some of my like favorite artists who, I don't know, some of my favorite artists, like, I wouldn't really want to work with them because I'm just like, why? Like, they don't need me. <They're good. laughs> Like, I mean, if I had an opportunity to work with Jaime Hernandez one day, like,
oh, yeah.
I'd say yes.
Dream team goal.
He's just down for Jaime, like, yeah, you know, P. Craig Russell is a fantastic artist who used to do a lot of Marvel and DC stuff, and now he did one of my favorite comics of all time. He adapted the opera The Ring of the Nibelung, which is in a hardcover by Dark Horse, which is an amazing book. I'd love to work with him one day because he's a writer, but I feel like there could be like. I could bring something to the table with that one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In terms of the relationship with writer and artist, I mean, there's a whole spectrum to that. You know, there's some writer artist relationships I've had with Mike Del Mundo on Weird World.
Oh my god! We love Weird World.
Yes, I do. And that his art on that book, and just the story.
God, right?
Oh my gosh! Mm-hmm. I felt that was one of the first really stories that I fell in love with when I first started working at Heidi Ho and we first bought the shop.
Oh, amazing!
Yes, mm-hmm. It was. I loved it.
Yeah, and you don't see Morgana Le Fay used a lot in comic books right now, and so I really she's like one of my low key faves. So I was glad that she was brought back, even if it was just for like a short time. But I love Morgana.
Let's make that low key fave a high key fave.
Yeah. I love all the magic users in the Marvel universe. They're so cool.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I don't know. I love that book. Mike and I love that book. It is like a real favorite where it didn't even make it to issue 7. But people tweet us about it like almost every day. Like somebody like is finding it for the first time and they're like they'll reach like a certain page or panel and they'll be like, I hate you so much. You did this. You know, or they're like, I'm crying right now. I didn't see this coming. And a lot of that book, like a lot of what's amazing about that book and a lot of like what I love about that book came from the collaboration that Mike and I had, because he and I just like got along. Like it's not always possible, but I try and talk on the phone with any artist I'm going to be working with on a regular basis and just be like, what's up? What are you reading? Like, what do you like to draw? Like, what's going on? You know, and he and I like really like, we just like, we're BFFs like right off the bat, just start talking about all this stuff. And one of my favorite parts of the book was a scene where the two main characters were fighting, they're arguing, and in the script, or in the outline maybe, I just said, oh, and then these two pages, they're just going to, like, talk it out and make up, and they'll be, like, friends again by the end.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike called me up, and he was like, yo, so for those, like, two pages, what do you think about, instead of them talking, what do you think about them having, like, a dance battle.
That's cool.
That is.
Yeah. And I was like, a what, dude? He's like a B-girl face-off. Like, talking about me. And I was like, what? I was like, I don't know how this is going to work, Mike, but you, like, you're feeling it so much. Like, I believe you can do this. So, for those two pages of the script, like, I basically said nothing but like, Mike, you know what you're doing here, go for it. And those are some of those pages that people come back to us with all the time. They're like, yo, I can't believe you did this. what's so cool about it is that Mike Del Mundo, here's some more chisme for you. He was a B-boy back in the day.
Oh!
Yeah! He used to do, like, B-boy battles and shit.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I've seen the YouTube videos. It's crazy.
There's YouTube videos? Oh, my God.
I I'm not gonna tell you what to look for.
Oh, I'm gonna look all over YouTube. I'm gonna find those videos now.
Yeah, and so it was just one of the things because Mike and I had always talked a lot about like our love for hip hop and stuff, and I knew it went deep. And so like when he came up with a crazy idea, I was like, "You got it, go for it." And it was just, you know, Mike. For Mike, it was really meaningful because it was like his little tribute, you know, it's like bridging his two worlds together. I don't know, when you can, like, when you're creators and you can do that kind of stuff, like, almost always 10 times better than whatever dumb scene I had in mind, you know? Like, when you can do something that's meaningful to you, like, you really put everything into it and it comes through on the page.
That's awesome. Yeah. That is really cool.
That is super awesome. So, this is Jen again. As is tradition for the Comadres y Comics podcast, you must share your chisme de la semana. What industry news has excited or bummed you this week? Or it doesn't even have to be about the industry. Just give us some good dirt.
I've already given you two pieces.
You sure have.
Yeah, you sure.
I'll tell you, I'm not going to spoil a chisme because if somebody listening hasn't seen it, like, I don't want to. I want to be a chismoso, but I won't be a spoiler either. So, what I am really, really excited for this week is Metal.
Oh, okay. That's right.
Yes.
You're doing a big DC. Red Death, right?
I'm doing the Dawnbreaker.
Dawnbreaker one shot. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. But I was part of, there was a story conference here in Burbank talking about like Metal, and we talked about all of Metal. We talked about like the forge and the casting, and all six issues and the tie-ins and everything. Like it was for 3 days. Like me and Scott Snyder and Jeff Williamson and James Tynan and some of the editors. And like, let me tell you, Metal is going to be so badass.
So, awesome. So many customers are waiting for that with bated breath.
Oh, good. Good, good, good. Yeah, and There's some cheese man Metal that came out just this morning.
Ooh.
Some really cool stuff. I'm not gonna spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen it, but you can go look for it if you want to see it, or you can see it at the end of issue one. But it's just like the stuff that came out today is like so indicative of like how cool Metal is and how fun it is. Yeah. Like, it is a big event, and there's, like, crazy shit going on all the time, and it's just, like, in your face, melt your face off, stuff. It's the Justice League versus the Dark Multiverse is, like, ooh, so cool and so much fun, and Scott's just, I mean, he knows what the fuck he's doing. Like, he's got this. He's got an amazing story. I've heard it all, and it's awesome. Like, the first time I heard the end, like, I just remember, like, I was just so blown away. There's so many fun, cool elements to it, and Greg Capullo is the motherfucking man. He is the man, the only man who can draw Metal, and he has drawn the hell out of it. I mean, that's a great example of how writer-artist collaboration can really result in some amazing shit, because I don't know that without Greg that Scott would have written Metal. Like, it's almost like a love letter to Greg. It's like, here's all this shit. I mean, they've had a long collaboration on Batman, but
right,
it's, like, it's like here's all the shit I really want to see Greg do, and here's all the shit that Greg's always talked about wanting to do.
Yeah.
And if you can lean into an artist of that caliber with that kind of stuff, like, it's gonna be magic, baby. It's gonna be magic.
That's pretty awesome.
That does. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
Great. So wait, what's your? I want to hear y'all's cheese, man.
Well, I'll start off. My cheese is that Brian Fuller has said that Hannibal season 4 is. Well, they're in talks to make it. Like I love Hannibal so much, and I'm so glad that they're gonna do a season 4 because season 3 was not enough.
I'm drawing a blank, guys, on my cheese. I am not prepared. What about you, Kristen?
Well, my chisme was not anything too chismosa at all. It was just kind of going to be talking about how Heidi Ho is doing their... we actually have a weekly trade paperback discussion group, and this week we are doing March, which was a book that I chose weeks ago, but unfortunately turned out to be very timely this week. So mm-hmm. that was going to be my chisme, that we're having a discussion group on March this Wednesday at 6:30 at Heidi Ho Comics.
And coming back to me, Sarah, this might be chisme to you because you don't know this. This is a repetitive chisme here. Here the Comadres y Comics are going to be at Latino Expo in Long Beach in November. So soon gone by, say hello.
Yeah.
Have a concha with us.
Yeah.
When is that?
It's in November, I believe, the
11th and 12th.
11th and 12th. Awesome. Yes. And... Very cool. Just in case you don't know, conchas are how we rate our and review our books that we talk about here on the Comadres y Comics podcast. And conchas are actually the concha is translated into the word shell in English, and it's the Mexican sweetbread that looks like a little seashell.
Oh, I know what that is.
Okay, yeah. So that's called a concha. And so when we talked about how we wanted to review our books here on the podcast, we all kind of talked about how conchas were like a big treat for us when we were kids. Uh-huh. And and that Jen said that three was the most that her mother ever let her eat. So three is the top rating. But if it's a really awesome book, we do three conchas plus a cup of champurrado, which is like a Mexican hot chocolate drink. And so that's how we rate our books. And just so you know, both Green Lanterns and Jonesy got three conchas and a cup of champurrado. I think we even maybe we gave it a rating of the whole panaderia.
That's right. I want that whole panaderia. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate you saying so.
Oh, well, thank you so much for coming on the show. Now, what's on your radar? Tell us about either a comic book, a show, or a book, or anything that you've heard of or are excited about or are currently enjoying and that others should check out.
Yeah, I got to go with, you guys ever heard of a TV show called The Mick?
The Mick. I've seen it on my feed, but I haven't seen it yet.
I've seen gift sets of it on Tumblr.
It's the Mick, it's spelled K-N-I-C-K. And it's like it was shown Cinemax with Clive Owen on it, and it ran for two seasons. It is like I never thought that I would call this like one of my favorite shows, or I would love a show like this so much. It's a medical drama about a hospital in Manhattan in 1901.
Oh, wow.
So it's like, what is it, General Hospital set in turn of the century?
The show could not have taken me by surprise more. I don't give a shit about any of those words I just said, basically. But it is a fantastic show. All the actors in it are amazing. And Steven Soderbergh directed all 20 episodes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he's just the way it all looks and feels together is fantastic. Clive Owen has never been better in it. Andre Holland is amazing in it. I just love all of it, and one of the best things about it is that it was canceled after two seasons, so they can't ruin it with a shitty season later on.
That's too bad. They canceled it after two seasons?
I think it was, Cinemax says they want to refocus on their action-oriented shows, which I think do better for them.
Okay. Well, I definitely have to check it out, because that premise that you described sounds really amazing.
Yeah, I like...
That's really cool, yeah.
I like period stuff, so that's going to be super cool.
I do have to warn you, it's like, they show, like, all sorts of, like, wild-ass surgeries that they did back in the day.
So
If you don't like blood and guts...
Well, I wanted to be a doctor at one point, so I'm all right with it.
It's going to be good.
This is Sarah, and I actually follow the pimple popper doctor on
Instagram. Oh my god!
Gore is my jam.
Oh my god. We're getting to the real cheese, man.
Well, besides that, now this is solely just for me and just because I want to know. You're an anime manga fan, right?
Oh, hell yeah.
So what are you watching right now? Like, oh, like what are you super into right now?
You know, I'll also like pivot on your question a little bit. Mm-hmm. The most exciting manga anime thing that I love right now is actually a manga, or two mangas, I should say. Mm-hmm. Have you guys ever heard of Princess Jellyfish?
Oh, oh yes. My god, yes!
I love
Princess Jellyfish.
Jen shoves Princess Jellyfish down anybody's throat who will listen. He walks into the shop.
Oh my god. So it was my favorite comic of last year. I fucking love that book so much.
Awesome. It is. Volume 5 just came out.
Yes, I know. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I have to like... I have to like chase myself, otherwise I'll just like plow through it in one day. So
yeah.
I haven't gotten into volume 5 yet, but mm-hmm. The creator Akiko Higashimura mm-hmm. has another book called Tokyo Tareeba Girls, which is also amazing and awesome. It's digital only at this point.
Okay. Through Crunchyroll?
Comixology.
Oh, Comixology. I said through Crunchyroll? Comixology. Or Comixology. All right, cool.
I don't know if it's on Crunchyroll or not. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely on Comixology. And it is also fantastic. It's about a group of 20-something friends in Tokyo mm-hmm. Who are... I mean, it sounds like just everything else you've ever seen. Mm. Bunch of 20-something girls, like, navigating work and relationships and stuff. But
yeah.
It's by Higashimura, so it's, like, it's just so good and so funny and so amazing.
I definitely have to look into that. Have you read Girl from the Other Side?
Girl from Another Time?
The Girl from the Other Side.
Girl from the Other Side. No, I don't think so.
That one's really good. It's like a fantasy all ages manga that is about uh-huh. this girl who is like basically like she's like 5 or 6 and she's kicked out of the town because they think she has a curse on her. And then an actual cursed creature comes to her and he like starts protecting her. And it is the cutest thing ever. And I really love it. I think.
Oh my god. Yeah. I'm like looking at that right now. It's like manga.
Jen is our resident manga expert.
Yes, I am.
Is it manga?
Huh?
It is manga. Okay.
Yeah,
cool.
It's manga. Mm-hmm.
So cool. It's got like almost like a little bit of a Death Note feel to it, huh?
Just a little bit, yeah.
Well.
Awesome.
We are coming to the end of our interview. Again, thank you so much for calling in and participating. We've had such a great time. But as is also tradition on Comadres y Comics, we end each episode with our segment called Juntos y Fuertes, which translates to Together and Strong. And that's the segment where we as a group really try to show love and support for members of marginalized groups within the comic community. So some of the things that we've kind of tried to bring to the forefront in the past on our show is we've discussed Sophie LaBelle, who's the creator of Assigned Male, and some of the stuff that she was dealing with and had to go through a couple of weeks ago, I think it was. We've highlighted the Asian American Comic Convention that happened in Los Angeles, which Sarah actually got to go to and meet George Takei.
I'm still so jealous.
Amazing.
Yeah. And also... Amazing. Sina Grace, writer of Iceman, who, a little interesting tidbit, used to be an employee of Heidi Ho Comics back in the day.
That's right. I knew that.
Yeah. So is there a creator, comic, or event that maybe you would like to share during this segment, Juntos y Fuertes?
Absolutely. It was hard for me to narrow it down to just one, but I'm going to give a shout-out to... Kylie Wu, I believe her last name is, She does a comic called Trans Girl Next Door.
Yeah.
She's an Asian American trans woman who does just this, like, it's like a fantastic web comic about her life. And of course that incorporates, sometimes incorporates being a trans woman and the realities of that, but sometimes it's just about, like, having crushes and hanging out with friends and, like, all sorts of stuff. She's just an amazing cartoonist. Her art style is so good and so expressive and, like, in the tradition of comic books, but also comic strips, and, like, she's got, like, some, like, manga elements to it, but also some, like, crazy, like, you know, Spumco, like the Ren and Stimpy.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Just, like, she just got, like, such a talent for, like, expression and caricature and all that kind of stuff, and she, like, her comics are always so funny, and they're on her website, which is Trans Girl Next Door, or you can, they're on her Tumblr or Twitter, and she is a Patreon, and she does great work, so.
That's awesome. There's so many great webcomics that are out there. Mm-hmm. I sometimes go overwhelmed with just how much good stuff there is.
Oh yeah, people are so creative, and a lot of the work that comes out is personal things, like where they're kind of sharing their experience in a kind of funny, comical way, and through a webcomic, which I think is amazing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, and. It's I don't know. It just goes back to what we said earlier. Like there are people out there. There are creators from marginalized groups out there. They're not just out there doing the work, but they're doing fantastic, vital work. You're not just ignorant if you're not paying attention. You're actually depriving yourself of some pretty amazing comics work out there.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I look forward to checking it out.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, same here.
Cool.
So, Mr. Humphreys, is there anything you're working on, anything you'd like the listeners to check out or, you know, or buy, comicsology-wise, some signings?
Just search Sam Humphreys and hit add all to cart. That'll do it. Or better yet, go to Heidi Ho.
Yes.
By two of everything. Let me see. Green Lanterns. We're in like a really crazy storyline right now with Green Lanterns, where Jessica and Simon are 10 billion years in the past. The very first Green Lanterns, the 7 original Green Lanterns we've never met before. That's a lot of fun. Really cool little thing I did for DC is this month is Jack Kirby's 100th birthday.
That's right.
And you know, I'm not alone here. Jack Kirby is one of my favorite creators of all time.
Yeah,
and they
yeah.
asked me to do a short story for one of their tribute one shots that they've done. So I did a short demon story with Steve Rude, which is cool. I mean, Steve Rude's a living legend, and just to do 6 pages with him was such an honor. And I believe that is in the Manhunter. It's the backup story for the Manhunter.
Yeah,
the Manhunter special.
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. And that comes out this month, I believe. And then I am doing Dawnbreaker, which is a one-shot tie-in to Metal, which is about a... I'm choosing my words carefully here. I forget if I'm sad about this, but the dark, you know, Metal is about the dark multiverse invading, and Dawnbreaker is one of the 7 dark Batman who come to invade.
Ooh.
And I know it covers that, so I can say that this is like a dark Batman version of Green Lantern.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Each one ties into a different member of the Justice League. Like, there's another one. Josh Williamson is doing Batman the Red Death, which is like a dark Batman version of the Flash. I forget who's doing it, but we were talking about the titles in Burbank when we were on the story conference together. And I remember they're talking about the Cyborg one, Dark Batman Cyborg. And they're like, it's called the Murder Machine. Batman the Murder Machine.
Nice.
I almost split the table. That is such a great title. Like, I'm so jealous. So then I had to come up with Dawnbreaker. And
Not bad. It sounds very cool.
That comes out in October. All those one-shots are looking great. And then Jonesy Volume 3 trade paperback comes out in September.
Yes,
keep
I can't wait
for that as well.
Well, I'm really I just finished reading Green Lantern's the second trade paperback, Volume 2, and I'm really I just wanted to say this to you. I'm really loving the aspect of Jessica Cruz and how she is relating with her anxiety and her being the Green Lantern. I love it.
Oh, good. Thank you so much. That really I love saying that I love hearing that doesn't quite hit the nail on the head, but it's like really special to me when people relate to anxiety because I have anxiety as well, and that's like, you know, at the very beginning, I kind of had to make a decision, like, was I going to skirt around this, or was I, like, really going to double down put everything, you know, all of my experiences and all my anxieties and all my actual fears and, like, actually put them on the page, and that can be, like, a very, you know, risky and vulnerable decision because if people hate it, like, they don't know if they're saying, like,
right,
I hate your life, I hate your anxiety, I hate your struggle, but, like, that's how it's going to come back to you. So it's like it's difficult to make that decision, but I was like, fuck it, like if not now, when? So like, I gotta do this now. And the response has been so huge, and you know, particularly from people like me who struggle with their own anxiety and stuff, so it's really special when people say that. And I don't know, I'm trying to look right now, but issue 15, which I do not believe is in the second trade, so it's coming up for you, but that is one of my favorite issues, and that deals directly with Jessica's anxiety. So keep an eye out for that one.
Oh, definitely.
Volume 3 should be coming out.
September, too.
Yeah, September as well.
It should be soon. Mm-hmm. It's been a little while, yeah.
Well, again, Sam, thank you so much for we've been on our little journey from the little piñata that could to now having you as having you as a guest on Comadrecy Comics, and you having Jessica hanging there in your office looking over.
She's right here with
you. Yeah. We really appreciate.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you so much for having me on the show. This was a blast. It was a lot of fun. I just want to say that I think it's really cool what you guys are doing. I'm glad you guys are doing the podcasts and the shows and your thing in November and working at the store and everything. I think what you guys are doing is really vital and it's really important, and the comics industry is lucky to have you. So I'm just happy to hang out with you guys and support with what you all are doing.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot. That does mean a lot. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Well, so thank you for letting me ruin your show.
Well, we hope that we didn't do anything too completely awful that would prohibit you from ever coming back in. The invitation is always open.
I would love to come back. Next time, though, I got to come hang out with you guys.
And one of the things I do when I'm promoting the podcast to people, I always say, to the guys, I always say, we're an all-girl podcast, but we do review beer. So if you come down, you'll have a beer with us and we'll review the beer together.
Hell yes.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, thank you guys again. Thank you for all your support. And of course, thank you for the piñata.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. My pleasure. My pleasure making it. It was so inspiring to make a piñata out of a Green Lantern that's Latina.
Yes. 100%. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, you also keep up the good work. And again, thank you so much for coming on. And this has been Comadrecy Comics. I'm Kristen.
I'm Jen.
And I'm Sarah. Bye.